Thanks for listening to another episode of Project Zion. This podcast explores the unique spiritual and theological gifts the Restoration offers for today's world. Project Zion is sponsored by the Latter-day Seekers team from Community of Christ.
Everyone, welcome to another episode of the Project Zion podcast. I'm your host, Brittany Mangelson, and today we have on Becky Savage from Independence. And for those of you that don't know, she was recently released from the first presidency of Community of Christ, and now she's serving as an evangelist in the Independence area. And we're really excited to have her on today, and we have a lot of things that I'm really looking forward to talking to her about. So, hello, Becky.
Hi, good to be with you.
So we had talked about different things that we wanted to highlight in this episode, but I think that we're going to kind of take a look at Becky's life from a bird's eye view and touch on several poignant moments from her life to reach a broad audience of people who can relate to her story and her experiences that she's had in the church. So let's start from the beginning. Let's start from your childhood.
Probably the easiest place to start is with my parents. They graduated from Graceland and on that very same day got married. I think kind of a bold move and very descriptive of my parents being very busy and all of what they did. But very shortly after their marriage, they were asked if they would be interested in being missionaries in Guatemala. Now, for our faith movement to be missionaries early in one's youth, or as one graduates from high school or college, is atypical. So my mom always wanted to be an archaeologist and saw this as a wonderful opportunity to go to a place and see if they could also discover some of the roots of the Book of Mormon. But as they accepted that opportunity to go to Guatemala, they were also just discovering they were pregnant. And so in their year in Guatemala, she came back just it would have been for World Conference, probably in April, and my sister and I were born in May. She came back in April, found out she was having twins, and did go back to Guatemala. And so my fraternal twin, Linda, and I were born in Guatemala in a doctor's office area. And Linda was, as the second twin, born 2 minutes later with a broken arm, and I. They were born with dual citizenship, which meant we were citizens of both Guatemala and the United States, and at the age of 18, had to make a decision of which country we chose to be citizens. Oh, so wow. I am a certified citizen, as in stood before a judge, raised hand, and made a commitment to be a citizen of the United States. We were told that if we'd been boys, we could have been conscripted into the Guatemalan army or military. So thank goodness we didn't get to do that. But parents came back with wonderful stories and lots of slides about their experience as missionaries in Guatemala. They purchased two costumes or a typical outfit of Guatemalan children, one as a boy and one as a girl. So my sister and I were the on-show pair. So we go around and do presentations with the slideshows and tell about the history. Mom would be dressed as a typical woman in the beautiful material Guatemalan mountain people, each village having their own particular design of their clothing. And Linda and I would take turns either being the boy or the girl. So very early on, we were on stage in terms of being in front of people and helping to tell the story of the church and the heritage of the church from a Book of Mormon perspective, as well as from a more modern opportunity to share the message of Jesus Christ within the church context, as my parents were early missionaries. When we were at age 8, my dad was asked to start working for the church, and for many, many years, that term, when one started working full-time for the church, said one went under appointment or was an appointee. And we were assigned as a family to Portland, Oregon. And they called it the Columbia River District, assigned as a missionary. And at the time of that assignment was an ordained elder. During the assignment there, he was ordained as a 70. And after 5 years in Portland, we were assigned to the Alaska District, which was quite an adventure. Alaska was considered an overseas assignment, which were typically a five-year assignment because of its distance and the difficulty of getting oneself there, transportation-wise, and any of our belongings there as well. We drove the Alcan Highway, which was a dirt-covered highway. You had to have special preparations. My dad put cardboard underneath the undercarriage of the car and lots of extra tires and had a special car carriage put on for the attachment on top of the car, this big square aluminum box that he had a friend make. And we camped our way up the Alcan Highway as a family and had we must have been quite the show, because we'd come up to a campsite, and four of us by then, four children. I have a younger sister, about 3 years younger, and a brother that's 4 years younger. So there were, with us twins, four of us under four, basically. But we could have our campsite tent set up with our bunk beds inside and dinner ready in less than 30 minutes. And there was a film crew for the old show called Bonanza at one of our campsites that came over to talk with us about how astonished they were that this family with these young children could have their campsite made in such a quick time. And they took pictures of our family. They were so impressed. But we had grown up camping. That was just part of the family adventure, to spend summers out camping in the church programs. And so it was all fun for us and quite the adventure. We were assigned in Alaska for 2 years. I cross-country skied to school. My younger brother and sister ice skated to school. That was kind of the norm. They left their ice skates on during the day with just the ice, the blade guard on, because they'd go out at recess and ice skate, and go out at lunch and ice skate themselves back home.
Oh,
it was,
man,
just the norm of the time. Yeah, it was a very adventuresome place. They had a campground at the time was out on an island on Lake Louise. So with the permafrost, you had to dig the new outhouse hole. Sometimes, depending on how many people were at the reunion, more than once during the week that we were together, that I caught my first rainbow trout at 2 a.m. in the morning, the light summer time, very tough time, and just had a great time with the people who lived in Alaska and the wonderful times together. My dad's parents had retired and asked the church where did they need them to go in ministry. We lived in Alaska in Anchorage while we were assigned there. They were asked to go to Fairbanks. And as retired workers, my granddad had been a carpenter, and my grandma was an accountant, actually, had worked for the church and Independence at the auditorium. They were asked to start a home church in Fairbanks, which they did, held the church in their basement as their home. And then granddad went out and cut down the big logs and built an A-frame-shaped building that became the Fairbank branch for many, many years. He did all of the framing and the interior work, and grandma painted the church. So they were the custodians and the early leaders of the church in Fairbank two of the years while we were there. So we got to see not only my parents as the leaders of the church as missionaries, but also my grandparents as leaders of the church. My younger brother in particular, but all of us, I think, were quite disappointed to leave Anchorage and go be assigned in a new place, and that was Columbus, Ohio. At that time, we would be at a world conference, and at the last day of world conference, they would ask all of the appointee families who were usually, they had reserved seats for us at the back of the auditorium chamber, and they would have us stand, and they would read the new assignment. So on the last day of conference, basically, you were given where you were going to go. Either you would be assigned to the same place or you would be given a new assignment.
Wow, that's intense.
Oh, yeah. And then they would, then we would sing, "I will go where you want me to go, dear Lord."
Oh.
That's your renewed commitment as a family to this new assignment, wherever that might be.
Oh.
So the assignment from Anchorage, Alaska was to Columbus, Ohio, which overall was just fine. My brother, younger brother, had been very engaged in Boy Scouts, or Cub Scouts, actually, I think, in Alaska. And it was the most difficult move for him to leave that area of acceptance. And he had this wonderful relationship with the scout leader, and to go to a place that was new. And Dad, who had been home more in Anchorage at any place he was assigned, he was assigned to this upper Ohio Valley region, which encompassed Ohio, Pennsylvania, and parts of New York. And he was gone the majority of the time. He was very rarely at home. So it was a big adjustment for him to go there. But quite a, administratively, probably a very good match to my dad's leadership skills.
Yeah.
My mom, all along these various assignments, she was a very gifted minister in her own way. She was a musician, both with vocal and flute and piano, a poet and writer, very gifted poet and writer, and one of the most spiritual people that I've encountered, and that's not just a bias as a daughter, certainly, but as someone who just knows Jean Amsbury Hirschman, a very blessed person and gifted person to be with. And it, no matter what the changes were, she adjusted to whatever they, those changes in assignments were, and met whatever the needs were. As someone who had been raised in a generation of the wife's responsibilities were to support the husband and the children in whatever way was necessary.
Yeah.
So, yeah, very, very important. And, you know, saw that model. Since Dad was gone, as the oldest child by 2 minutes, I still took that role on as the older, oldest of four, and became basically the second parent. And so Mom had took a job in downtown Columbus. And so we'd come home from school and I was the parent at home. At least my siblings confirmed that with me. I don't remember doing much about it, but they confirmed that I was. And we would take care of things as they needed to be taken care of. When Dad came home, it was a different household. Because Dad was home, he was in charge, and we did things as Dad wanted them done. But when he was away, we had a different family. Mom was basically head of household, and we could do a more relaxed atmosphere and have things a little more casual, you know, certainly very social and supportive family unit in both instances, but very different kinds of family units with a matriarch versus a patriarch in the family.
Yeah.
I graduated. I'm sure people have had different kinds of experiences in those two arrangements of family.
Yeah, yeah.
I graduated from high school from Columbus, Ohio, and then went on to nursing school. And from the various earliest time of my life that I can remember, I wanted to be a nurse. And having grown up as an appointee child, one of the expectations that was put upon us was that we always were on show. And I would describe it as being in a glass box.
Mm.
So we were looked at as someone who, or because we were the children of the minister or the appointee or the paid church staff member, we were expected to be good all the time, to have the right answers in Sunday school, to be available to help with whatever needed to be done wherever we were at. And when you're in that type of position, you can adapt to it or not. So in our family, I filled that responsibility and felt a responsibility to fill that role. My younger sister followed that responsibility fairly well. My twin sister and my brother both rebelled against that kind of responsibility. So it's kind of interesting to see kind of every other one of us followed along in a different way.
Yeah. So. Well, it's a lot of pressure, I'm sure. I mean, especially when you're a kid, you just want to be a kid, not necessarily have to look the part or act appropriately all the time. And yeah.
Absolutely. They also had within the family support from both mom and dad to say, what is it that you want to do in terms of your long-term life goals? And Stoltz supported from an early age that if nursing was what I wanted to do, then nursing could be my ministry throughout my life. And of course, growing up within the church structure, men were priesthood and women were supportive and roles as whatever was needed. In nursing, there was the opportunity for multiple ways of expressing one's career. So by being a nurse, I could be certainly a hospital nurse and serve at the bedside. I could be an educator. I could work in different kinds of age groups. So I did a specialty, I'll explain a little bit more, in pediatrics, care of families, children and families. There's home care and community health and just multiple ways in which one can express ministry and service in a career that is so broad in terms of ways in which you can express that particular career based on education and where one is and the opportunities that are provided. So I was off to Graceland nursing program as dad was still assigned in Columbus, Ohio. And my twin sister came to Graceland for 1 year and part of the first semester. And then she went with a friend off to Miami, Florida, and we lost track of her for a couple of years, which was a bit traumatic for all of us, not knowing where she went and how she was doing. We kind of knew where she went, but we just didn't know how she was doing. So that's kind of how I grew up in the church. My dad from Columbus was assigned back to Independence to what would be a human resources type function in the church now. They called it administrative services and ministerial personnel at the time. And from that assignment, 2 years later, was called into the Council of 12 in 1974, the same year I graduated from Graceland as a nurse, was the year that he was called in to the Council of 12 as an apostle.
So what about being a nurse do you think helped inform or shape your future ministry with the church?
Nurses are taught that we look at the whole person, and that would include the physical, mental, social, spiritual aspects of an individual and all of their circumstances. So when we're talking about ministry, and particularly some of the most recent sections of 160 or of the Doctrine and Covenant, 160, starting with 163 and even through 165, in particular with President Beebe, and even some of what President McMurray was talking about a little bit before that. Actually, even to 156 with the call to the temple, there's this whole emphasis on the aspect of wholeness of ministry and the wholeness of Jesus Christ. So in terms of nursing career and the focus of how one brings about health, wholeness, healing, it includes all of a person, all the aspects in which they are encountered. So in nursing, one encounters an individual and or the individual and their family in the circumstances where they're not whole for whatever circumstance they're encountered with in the emergency room, and they're having surgery, they're having an illness, or they're out of their normal circumstances. They're in a place of unwholeness or lack of wholeness. And as nurses, we're taught to help that individual and their family to seek wholeness. So we're not the one necessarily who brings about that wholeness. We're helping, facilitating, and navigating the person through all of what it takes to bring them back into a place of wholeness. In nursing, we're looking at that individual as one who is already capable of being whole. So the idea of God as gifting and calling each person as a person of worth is included in this concept of wholeness. No matter the circumstances that we find an individual in within the nursing arena, they're already seen or visualized as someone that is whole and of worth. So when you come into a servant ministry type of a role within ministry, within the church, and encountering individuals along one's life, they just mesh very well. There is no disconnect to that whatsoever. It is just this automatic connection. Whether the words change a little bit, I mean, I learned to adapt words pretty easily between the church and the healthcare arena. They mesh really easily. I may not, in a healthcare arena, say Jesus Christ, but in teaching leadership development, leaders are servant leaders in healthcare, just as ministers and disciples are servant leaders and servant ministers within the church and how we approach that. So foundationally, I had a foundation within the church from childhood on in terms of Jesus as servant leader. Within nursing, had the foundation of wholeness of each person, and they're already being on a pathway of acceptance. It's already there. And you put those two within a framework of life and journey, and it all fits together.
Yeah. I love that ministry can happen outside of church. And that it doesn't have to be only focused on what's happening in the congregation or building a congregation or whatever, that you can find those moments for ministry wherever you are in the secular world.
Absolutely.
So let's talk about your initial call then to priesthood. So you said that you felt a sense of call to elder. What was it like, I guess, to have your call presented? Did it turn out how you thought it would? Did you have to wrestle with it at all? What was that process like?
I'm going to put this in kind of an interesting context for you. My husband and I were dealing with infertility for many years in our marriage and had come to, after multiple testing of all kinds of things, and determined that I had endometriosis and that I had several surgeries, actually culminating in a total hysterectomy. The pastor came to the hospital and after my surgery and indicated that she wanted to come and have a visit with me once I came home. She had actually walked with me in the hallway as I was doing some of my post-op exercising. And so the week after I was discharged from the hospital, she came to have a visit and to present my call to elder. And she said she had been waiting for over a year to present the call. And part of the reason for waiting was my need to be physically healed. So the physical circumstances of dealing with the endometriosis and all the stuff that was going on in my physical body was part of what was holding up my call to elder. So while I had no idea that that was part of what was going on, it was interesting that even as a future minister, and as one who had responsibility in helping to discern others' calls to priesthood, it was one of those, well, yes, we have to look at all of people's circumstances in their life. It's not just the spiritual aspect of one's call. It's the holistic aspects of one's call to priesthood that must be considered. And this was just one very good example of the physical condition and readiness of someone has to be considered in a call. So the call was to elder, as I expected. And I think because I had already been involved with a lot of leadership, so I had been teaching in the nursing program for 7 years. In 83, I took a position at the Children's Hospital to work in as a clinical nurse specialist in the renal area, and was asked to start a peritoneal dialysis program from scratch. And what that entails is hospital board, state, and federal approval, writing from scratch all of the policies and procedures for how you care for children in those circumstances. It meant literally touching every single department within the hospital structure, from housekeeping or facilities to billing and administration. All of that entails leadership responsibilities and how you work with others in all kinds of levels of leadership, and how you interface with other kinds of leaders within a hospital, state, and federal responsibilities. Now, that's all secular, but elders deal with leadership in all kinds of ways, certainly within the structure of a church or a congregation, also within the personalities and the social situations and the work type of environments of members within the congregation. And while one is a leader or has leadership responsibilities, perhaps as pastor of a congregation, one is only effective as a leader when one works and helps others as leaders within the congregation to actually bring their giftedness to bear in the congregation. So the leadership skills I was already using in my work actually were a model or an example or the demonstration of what kinds of skills one needs to bring in the role as an ordained elder. So that was part of why the matching of those kinds of giftedness and the expression of that giftedness was already apparent. I was using some of those same work-related skills in just the work within the congregation, and how I worked with camps as a camp nurse, at youth camps, those kinds of things. So that's how it just felt a natural blend of work and church in terms of the call to elder.
Awesome. So as you were being called to elder, what vision, I guess, did you have for your ministry? Did you think it was going to stay more local? I mean, at that point in time, did you have any inkling that it would go above and beyond elder? I mean, and I know that we don't like to consider priesthood a hierarchy, but I mean, going from elder to first presidency, I mean, there definitely is there's a jump there, steps to take. So did you see or sense, where the call would take you ultimately?
Absolutely not. No, there was absolutely no inkling at that time beyond it. No. And part of this is, this absolute conviction that I was never going to work for the church. So my ministry was in nursing. That was my path of contribution and ongoing giving in terms of my life. I had been a appointee's child. We had as a family given sacrificially, and I chose my career path and my ministry path. And I was fine with that. That's where I was going. So, there was a couple times when someone would say along the way, and I'll get to that a little bit later, but, have you ever considered working for the church? And I said, absolutely not. That was my adamant response. I'm not going to do that. Been there and done that as a family. That's it. So I'm very happy in my office as elder. That's where I was called and where I expected to stay.
So I guess the natural question is what changed? What made you look into stepping into this deeper, or have a switch of roles, or what have you?
I was in healthcare for 29 years. And as I said, I worked at Graceland teaching in nursing pediatrics as the primary focus. Worked at the Children's Hospital in Kansas City for many years. And once starting that peritoneal dialysis program, transplant program, was advanced into a director of nursing program or position, and then recruited to Tampa, Florida, from basically 138-bed hospital to an 880-bed hospital as the director of nursing there. And within a year, had the opportunity to apply for a position as a director of leadership development, and had to start brand new program there as a director of leadership development, which allowed me this whole new opportunity to start a new program based on Jesus leaders as servant leaders. Certainly Jesus, the servant leader, was the model, even though I couldn't use that particular terminology in leadership. In the that large healthcare system. So first year as a director of nursing, basically second year as director of leadership development, but within 9 months as a leader, director of leadership development, had to apply for my job again because we consolidated with the sister hospital in St. Petersburg. And less than 3 years later, I was applying for my job again because we consolidated as a 10 hospital healthcare system with 16,000 employees, home health, lab services, outpatient sites, freestanding physician offices, and very high stress, demanding position. I had 38 staff in that position and had to reduce them to 19 in 3 years. So what had been my ministry and my calling was beginning to take its toll. Just before that last 3 years, Jim and Jan Slaughter, Jim was an apostle at the time, had come to Tampa for a congregational retreat, basically, or weekend kind of ministry. And Jim and Jana called my husband and I aside and asked if we would consider coming to work for the church. Now, I did the same thing to him as I had done to others and said, absolutely not. But I went to work after that conversation, and things that had brought joy started to not bring joy. So the aspects of working within a healthcare system that I could deal with, all of the stress and all of the politics of working within 10 hospital healthcare systems that I had dealt with before, now became difficult. And over that 3 years, this call of, would you consider coming to work for the church, kept creeping in to my psyche. And it was affecting my satisfaction and my ability to be joyful, I guess would be the word, or ability to adapt as well within the healthcare system. It was about March of 2001 maybe, Greg and I were on a vacation in the Allegheny Mountains, Blue Ridge Mountains. Greg has always scheduled our vacations because if he didn't, I wouldn't take one. And we were in the springtime, which is a beautiful time, and had the windows down, doing a little slow drive through the parkway. And there was this very distinctive voice that said, the time is now, the time is now. And I made us go back early from our vacation because I had a meeting we needed to go to. And when I got back, I had this opportunity to leave the position with financial grace, which left us in a good situation, and was made the decision to go ahead and put my application in to work for the church. So I left healthcare after 29 years in June of 2001 and did a consulting position in another little hospital in Central Florida for several months, and had a call to come and interview for the position in the church in September, and then a subsequent call back in October of 2001, and started a new position in January of 2002. Now, Greg had been asked also, he started working for the church also in September of 2001 as a financial officer for two mission centers. So he was doing Florida and the Southeast mission center. So he had responsibility for Georgia, North and South Carolina, and then also for the Florida mission center. Did a lot of travel. I was assigned as the missionary coordinator and congregational consultant for the Florida mission center. And my responsibilities were basically to take what I'd been doing as director of leadership development in the healthcare system and apply that to working in congregations. And then also to add the element of missionary coordinator, which was helping to work with the local 70 and helping to develop missionary coordinators in local congregations to help grow invitational ministry in the Florida Mission Center. So it was literally now taking healthcare leadership development skill sets, now applying those back into congregations in the local mission center. At the time, I think we had 26 congregations in that geographic area. So I, in that position, working for the church, I was in that role for a total of 4 years, that I woke up the second, literally the second year to the day of starting the position in Florida. And I told Greg, I feel good. And that meant physically well and healed from basically the last several years of extremely high stress in the healthcare position that I've been in. So it was a blessing, literally a blessing and a healing experience to come work for the church. It was in that call beginning role in January 2002 where the second call to priesthood came as a call to high priest. And I had been sensing that call for well over a year, at least a year. And part of that was because of increased responsibilities in the mission center and work that I had been doing mostly at the general mission center gathering. So when that call came, about the same time I was interviewing for the position, for the mission center position as an appointee there, it was kind of an overlap. The call and the assignment to that role were about simultaneous.
Awesome. I love
that.
I was just going to say, I love that you were able to bring your ministry as a nurse and your career and skill set as a nurse and just kind of transfer them right over to church stuff. I'm sure that helped the transition a little bit because you were comfortable with what you were doing and things like that. And were able to bring giftedness to the church with skills that you had been acquiring for, you know, your career as a nurse. I think that's really a wise use of our resources.
Yeah, that's true.
So one thing that you had mentioned we had a little preliminary conversation before, and you'd said that one thing that you did want to lift up in this interview was the death of your sister and how that kind of affirmed and solidified your faith in Jesus Christ, and that happened, I think, if I'm remembering right around this time. Is that correct?
Actually, she died in 1987.
Okay.
So let me go back a little bit. Remember me saying that when we started to college, she came the first year and then left kind of in the middle of the first semester of the second year. And we lost track of her for a couple of years. She made a call, kind of out of the blue from Florida and said, Dad, if you'll send, bus money, I'll come home. And I would tease her or vice versa and say that I'm 2 years older or two minutes older, but she got 2 inches taller. And I was always envious of her being 2 inches taller. When she came back, she weighed about 100 pounds. So it's a 5'6" tall, about 100 pounds. So really, really thin, had been working as a waitress and, you know, trying to make it on her own. And it was kind of her time to find herself, and to get away from the pressure of having grown up as a appointee's kid. And when she came back, she went to LPN school, and she started to at least share some of what it was like to be the second twin, to me. Now, these are stories I knew nothing about, experiences where she said she would bring her friends home from school. And once they met me, they were only my friends, not hers. But she had a favorite teacher in junior high in Alaska. And they had a spring field trip to go out and find fossils. And you could invite a friend or, you know, family member. She invited me to go. And after that spring trip, he only called her Becky. He never called her Linda. And kind of this building of hurt in her life that she used her time away to kind of repair and find herself. And during this repairing time, we got to find out who each of us, you know, who Linda was and who I was as adults. She had her daughter, Kim, and we were not able to have children. So Kim was as much felt like our first daughter and certainly was her first and only daughter. She worked nights and Greg and I would help take care of Kim because her husband also was a nurse and he worked nights a lot. And so they needed child care and we would help out. We took Kim to reunion with us and things like that. So I'm at Children's Mercy in my position, and at 8 o'clock meeting, I get a phone call, and the phone call was Linda died. I'm thinking, I guess all of our family members responded with Linda who? And she's been working at a home for visually impaired or school for visually impaired kids. She was the one who stayed up at night and sat at their bedside when they were having bad dreams and were alone. Her house and their very poor neighborhood, this little tiny house, was the safe house. So kids who were getting beat up and kicked out by their alcoholic dad or mom came to her house. Women who were abused and needed to run away from being abused came to her house. I mean, all of these things after she's going to have this troubling life and life was getting back to order. And I get this call, Linda died. And it was Linda who? Oh my gosh, Linda who? And it was my sister. Mm. She was 37. And autopsy showed that she died of a massive heart attack. And Linda had started smoking at age 13 and had had other medical issues, terrible migraines. She'd been on medication that had was known to cause bundle branch blockage. This is a major electrical conduit part of the brain, of the heart. And she had been off of it for 6 weeks and was just being put back on that medication. So, you know, it could have contributed to it. We don't know. But out of the blue, Linda died. And just as she was making all these wonderful contributions and had her life in order. And my response was, if God can make and take such a life, then I did not want to be involved with God. And I did not want to be involved with my family. And I didn't want to be a wife anymore. And I didn't want to be a mother anymore. And the audience won't know that we, you know, waited nearly eight years to adopt our first daughter and two more to adopt our second. And I didn't want to be a nurse anymore. And went into an extremely, extremely dark place where I did not want to be involved in anything whatsoever that my life had revolved around to that point. In the midst of my considering whether to come work for the church, I was reviewing all of that circumstance. And I had at the time, I had to go get counseling because I personally was not able to get myself out of the dark place. And my family was not able, because of my alienation of them, was not able to help me get out of that place. So in the midst of reviewing, did I want to come work for the church? I looked back over that time and what helped me move from that terrible place of depression and separation. And it came to the realization of Linda and I's experience at baptism. At the time, Camp Donovan, which is a big reunion ground near Independence, on our baptism, we used to meet in this great big huge tent. And it set, I mean, several hundred people. And we had these creaky old wooden chairs and sawdust down on the ground. And I remember, you know, swishing my feet in the sawdust and making patterns in the sawdust and listening to this, you know, person at the front who was kind of drolling on about what baptism was all about. But in the midst of that, way up front, there was a white light that appeared. And in that light, there was an adult walking hand in hand with a child. Everything, all the noise of that big tent and all the children around and everything that was going on went silent. All I saw was that figure, that image of the adult and the child. So in the midst of the darkness of dealing with Linda's death, the image of the adult holding onto the child's hand came back. And I came to understand that the image was Jesus holding my hand, walking me out of darkness and into light. And just that opportunity to have the hand available, no matter what I did in terms of alienating myself from everything that has been a part of my life allowed me to make a new start. So coming out of the light, hand in hand, I got to choose to be a mother again. I got to choose to be a wife again. I got to choose to be a daughter, sister again. I got to choose to be a nurse again. I got to choose to walk hand in hand with Jesus again. And I got to choose to be a part of a congregation and a part of a community of Christ again. And no matter what I've encountered since that time, the stress and the circumstances of terrible, horrific work in the Tampa Bay area and that job, no matter the loss of my mother with Lou Gehrig's at 67, recent loss of my dad with dementia, other loss of friends and circumstances, no matter what, I have an image that stays with me and confirms for me that Jesus walks with me in those circumstances, no matter what. And I know without a doubt that that same hand is extended to every single person, no matter their circumstances. Every single person, the hand is extended and offered. All we have to do is open our hand and accept it. Now, for some, that may seem very difficult, but I assure you, the hand is there. All one has to do is grab hold. So what my sister's death gave me was new life. And I am forever grateful for Linda's gift. It has blessed my life tremendously. I mean, I would not wish for anyone to have to go through a traumatic loss to have to get to this kind of experience. However, I am tremendously blessed to have had a sister who gave me this life-giving opportunity. So I say with absolute assurance that Jesus walks hand in hand with each of us, and that the opportunity is available for each of us to have that hand walk with us as well.
Wow, that's beautiful. Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. I think that in those crossroad moments, we have a lot of different ways that we can choose to react. And I think that I look at moments in my life that haven't necessarily been as heartbreaking. But I think that we do all have tragedy. And I think that there's sometimes where I probably haven't reacted in the most productive way or grace-filled way. So I'm just grateful that you were able to turn such a hard tragedy into something beautiful, and to have that realization and to be able to recognize that God still is in those moments. And I really appreciate it. And I think that the church has been mightily blessed because of your continued yes and your continued journey forward in your ministry. So thank you. I mean that. Thank you. So let's move on and talk about your call to the First Presidency. I know that it was kind of a quick, I don't know if I want to say turnaround, but kind of turnaround to going from being an appointee to being called into the First Presidency. So what I'm specifically wondering about that is, I guess, did you see it coming at all? And how was the call presented to you? And specifically, did you feel like you were a token woman that was just there for appearances? Or do you really feel like your call was genuine and you were being called because of who you were and what you could bring? Or do you think that you were called first and foremost because you were a woman and it was an appearance thing, I guess? And I assume that I know the answer, but I want to hear it from you.
Okay. Circumstances of the call and timing. So I had been assigned in 2002 in the Florida Mission Center. In 2006, there was a reorganization underway with field staff, and was expecting to take a different position shortly in the spring. And it was in Independence area, attending a meeting with Apostle Linda Booth and her team, and we were talking about changes that were coming. At that first day of that meeting, President Ken Robinson came to me at the lunch break and asked if I had considered applying for the Director of Leadership Development position, which had been posted. I had looked at that, and it was for the whole church. It's a worldwide, church-wide position as Director of Leadership, reporting to Ken Robinson, so who was going to report to the First Presidency, and that was the first time that position would have that type of authority, reporting to the First Presidency. So I told him I had looked at the position description. The position description looked like it was written for me because the responsibilities paralleled the responsibilities I had as Director of Leadership Development in the healthcare system. And I said I had looked at it, that I had just made a commitment to Papa Booth for my new role and what would happen to Greg, because he had responsibilities in the two mission centers already. And President Robinson said, would I be willing to come to his office so he could give me answers to my, he could give the answers to my questions. At the time we were staying at my dad's house, and I said, President Robinson asked me to come, if I would come to his office to talk about this position. And my dad said, when a member of the First Presidency asks to talk with you, you say yes. Okay, Dad. I went to his office and met with him for over 2 hours, and he was talking about this position. And he says, I don't even know who you are. I said, I really don't know who you are, Becky Savage, but your name keeps coming up, coming to my mind. He said, it's been very unusual times, and I think you should consider strongly applying for this position. And so this time it didn't take 3 years. It took me 3 days to kind of think my way through why I shouldn't apply for the position. But about 3 days later, I woke up with, if I applied for this position and was selected, then I could take what I learned in the healthcare system as Director of Leadership, and we could apply it this way in the church and this way in the church. And what if this would work? And how about if we could teach this and this? And got all excited about it. And so submitted my application. And I came in May on a Monday night to apply for interviews on Tuesday night, quite around like three interviews with 20 plus people in each room, three 1 hour interviews. And on Thursday, I was headed to the airport to go back home. And I got a call from the HR director at the time, asked where I was. And I said I was on my way to the airport. And he said, well, can you change your plan? And I said, well, yes. And he asked me to come back, and he offered me the position. And I called Greg, and we decided I could accept the position. President Robinson said if I took the position, they would find something for Greg to do in terms of a position in the Independence area. We had to go on faith that that would happen. And I went home 3 weeks later to put our house on the market. So this was May 11th. And we moved into a new house in Lee Summit, south of the Independence area, July 4th, and moved right in, obviously, in the midst of what was happening at headquarters, which was a major downsizing of staff and a reorganization of the whole organization at the headquarters area, right in the midst of me starting this new Director of Leadership Development. In January, the first Monday in January of 2007, President Veazey had arranged to have a meeting with me on a leadership issue, and he was scheduled to come to my office, and I had my pad and paper out ready to talk with him. I'm the Director of Leadership Development. He's coming to my office to talk to me about leadership development, you know, a leadership issue. That makes sense. It's the beginning of the new year. Okay. So he comes in, and anytime President Veazey comes to talk with anytime, he always starts the meeting with, how are you? How is your family? And so that's how the meeting started, is how are you and how is your family? How's Greg doing in his position, and how are the girls? So we went through that, and it was very pleasant, just put one at ease kind of way. And then he said, I have come to present to you a call to be a counselor to the president of the church and a member of the first presidency. And he says, I'm pretty sure I did, put my right hand over my heart and said, "Are you sure?" I know I said, "Are you sure?" In retrospect, my thought was, that was pretty audacious on my part to say to the president of the church, "Are you sure?" My response was, in my head, my internal response was, "My gosh, you don't know me under stress. You really know what you're getting. Oh, my heavenly days." He went on to describe his experience of discerning my call to the presidency. And it was, there were various things about that in terms of my interest in the needs of women and their need for self-assurance and confidence in their calls to priesthood and ministry, and validation of those calls, issues related to diversity and acceptance of all persons within the arenas of the church, which was areas of passion for me because our two daughters are both beautiful women of color, and the issues that we faced with prejudice in various situations as we raised our daughters, how could have an impact on leadership development in the role in the first presidency that I could never have as just a director of leadership development. So I heard him in my head. He said, "You can talk with Greg and you could have some time." Said, "But if you would consider even the possibility that you might say yes," this is on a Monday, "I would like you to join the first presidency in our retreat. And oh, by the way, we're leaving Monday and you can't tell anyone." So I called Greg and he came over about the lunchtime from his meeting he was involved in. And I sat him down and said, "Greg, I had a meeting with President Beasley and he's called me to be a counselor to the president of the church and a member of the first presidency." And he said, "I know." And I went, "What? How can you know?" He says, "I know. This is January 2007. In October of 2006, he wrote a letter to our daughters and sent a copy to himself, postdated October 31st, 2006. And in the letter it says, 'I have come to understand that your mother will be called to be a counselor to the president of the church and a member of the first presidency.'"
Whoa.
Yeah. So I heard President Beasley in my head, but I heard Greg in my heart. And it was conversations with people like President Robinson, who said, "Since October, I have heard your name as being called to the presidency." And went to my dad. I had permission to go talk to my dad and said to his dad, "Dad, I need to tell you something." He said, "Okay." I said, "President Beasley came to talk to me about this call." And he looked at me and he went, "I have absolutely no confirmation of that call whatsoever." And then I went, "Thank you, Dad. It's two of us. There's no confirmation." And he shook his head and he said, "Wait a minute. What did you say?" So I repeated the call, what Steve had said. He looked at me and he said, "I may not have confirmation of that call, but your mother did. And she died 10 years before." I'm like, what? So I had, in my thesis work in the seminary, I got to open letters for the first time out of the archives of women's responses to hearing the presentation of the document that became Section 156 from the Doctrine and Covenant. And that was an amazing experience to look at their written response to that experience. And then I got to open another set of letters, and it was of women's response to their call to priesthood. And in their calls to priesthood, they kind of fell in two categories, their responses. And I put them more as the internal assurance and the external affirmation. So in the internal assurance, this group of women had a sense of their call for many years this kind of, I know I have a call, and when it is presented, and when it was presented, it was just this, a confirmation of what they already knew and had been a part of their ongoing internal assurance of this ministry that was being given to them. It just had to be confirmed through this new opportunity that came with the Section 156 for the church. The second end of this continuum, it really is a continuum of those at one end with this really firm assurance, internal assurance that they have a call. At the other end was this group of women who had absolutely no inkling that they had a call to priesthood and had accepted their call based on the testimony of others. So they would have certainly the presentation by their pastor or, well, be their pastor, bring that call to them about their call to a priesthood office. And they would need the testimony of the pastor, testimony perhaps of a spouse, the testimony of other members of priesthood, testimony of members of the congregation, and need to have the affirmation of others that confirms the call, because their own affirmation of the call was not there. So for my call to elder, my call to high priest, I'm at one end of the continuum of affirmation, absolutely assured of a call. My call to first presidency, I'm clear at the other end of the continuum. No inclination of a call whatsoever. Except I can go back a little bit and think what had happened. 2002, at World Conference, now I'm working for the church. I'm there helping in the World Conference with the delegates. Before that World Conference, I had this internal sense of you need to make yourself better known outside of World Conference, known outside of Florida. People in Florida know who you are, but no one else knows who you are. So I came with my best business suit just so people, I mean, you saw that how people dress at World Conference, pretty casual if you're a delegate, you know, to a full range of full dress. So I came with my suit and I wore my suits all week. I started volunteering to teach classes at what was then called Congregational Leaders Workshops in August up at Graceland, and coming to some of the workshops that were at Peace Coffee at headquarters, and whenever there were other kinds of events, taking class at Winterfield School and things like that. So I would be seen with other leaders just because I got that sense. In October of 2006, I'm at my desk sorting through paperwork, and I had the, you need to prepare yourself. There's going to be an additional call. And I can distinctly remember saying to myself, that's ridiculous. You just got here. That's ridiculous. You just got here. No, that you need to prepare yourself. There's going to be another call. There was no what kind of a call. It was just, you can have another call as into priesthood. It was just a sort of total denial. That's ridiculous. You just got here. So I agreed that even if the possibility was there that I might say yes, I agreed to go on the retreat with First Presidency to Colorado. So I'm in the mountains again. Now, 3 years, that 3 year kind of, we consider working for the church in the Allegheny Mountains was the time is now. And in the Colorado Mountains in January with a broken foot. And with three members of the First Presidency. And if there was any inclination that there would be a different treatment of a woman versus men, we shared the responsibilities for making breakfast. And then there was no, you have to take care of us kind of a situation at all. This was all shared. And we met in the morning, and the first question was, how are you doing? How's your family? And President Beasley shared, you know, his concerns about the World Conference and vulnerability about pending words of counsel. And we shared together in prayer and then had quiet time that I used as my consideration of would I accept the call to the First Presidency. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, I said yes. I said to President Beasley, I am saying yes, not on my own personal confirmation, absolute confirmation of this call, but on faith that others confirm the timeliness of the call for me. And because you have said that this is a call for a period of time, I had no doubt that a woman would be called into the presidency. And I had some of the women in mind who would be appropriate to call into the first presidency. But my name was not on that list. So that was me was definitely a surprise. So having been presented, the call having been presented at World Conference, we're in the Saturday night of a receiving line. You didn't experience it at this conference. It used to be this very formal line where members of the presidency and their spouses stand in this formal line, and they, people who want to be, have the time to shake hands, all line up, and this can be several hours long where people go through this receiving line. And in this receiving line, one of the gentlemen shook my hand and said, "I am so glad there's going to be a wife in the first presidency." Oh. I said, "Oh, no, there isn't." And I said something, I repeated it to the my colleagues a little later the next morning, and they went, "Oh, no, 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 no." And the morning after the ordination service, President Vesey made a statement to the conference, in essence saying it goes without, it cannot go without notice that for the first time, there is a woman in the first presidency. And then he went on to explain that in the first presidency, we are all equal. We each have different responsibilities. And then he explained what I was being assigned as my responsibilities as over the headquarters functions and leadership development, issues of diversity, and that would look at women's issues, but multiple other issues of diversity, and that President Shaw was going to be responsible for human resources and field ministry. He didn't explain his, which obviously is oversight for everything, but he also had the evangelist, presiding evangelist, presiding bishop, the president of the High Priest Quorum reported to him. So, and then we shared lots of other responsibilities. But anyway, he wanted to make it very clear from the start that this was an office of equality, that we would stand together in terms of each having responsibilities that were of equal, we were all equal in terms of our responsibilities as leaders in the first presidency. Now we know that, that there are some unique responsibilities for the president as the prophet of the church. Only President Vesey can bring prophetic counsel to the church. And as counselors to the president of the church, we serve in an advisory role for him as well. So that has a uniqueness in terms of our specific roles as counselors. But when we meet together as a presidency, we meet with equal voice and share together in very equal conversation. I've said to President Vesey and to others that over the breadth of my career and multiple supervisors, vice presidents that I reported to, et cetera, I never had someone who treated me so equally. And I've reported to men and women in my career. This was an extraordinary experience of truly being someone of equal, treated equally at the table, and one who was appreciated for the giftedness that I brought. Always felt that I was appreciated for the giftedness that I brought to the table. For that, I'm very, very grateful.
So
at the conference, I might tell you, let me just give you one little, can I give you a funny
anecdote? Please do.
So at World Conference, I was obviously known in the Florida Mission Center. So I, when I went to meet with some of the folks from Florida, I had heard also kind of through the grapevine that there's the most common kind of phrase going around was, "Who's this Becky Savage? Who is this Becky Savage?" People who knew I was a Hirschman and knew my dad and our family knew who I was, and obviously from Florida and from our former Kansas City state. So that's kind of a small group of people who knew who I was. So when I was with the Florida Mission Fair folks, they said, we were just in the elders, mass meeting of elders, and somebody got up and said that I looked too young to be a member of the presidency. And I said, well, wasn't that nice? As I'm walking the row and saying hi to people from the Florida Mission Center, somebody in a delegation right behind them said, saw me and went, oh, you're Becky Savage. You look older in person.
Oh.
Okay, thanks. I don't know if it was the same person or not. Reality check.
Oh, man. Yeah, what do you say to that? Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
Oh, goodness. So I guess, did the historic nature of your call weigh on you at all? Did you feel like because you were a woman, you had to prove yourself more, or that you had to earn your place more? Or did you feel, I mean, you've said that among the presidency, you were accepted and you were embraced and things were equal. But did you have moments outside of dealing with just the first presidency that you encountered just that internal sexism, whether it's a microaggression or something larger? Or did you feel like you had to kind of overcompensate for being a woman?
That's a good way of phrasing it. There were times, certainly, when there were individuals who were less than respectful, noting I was female. But for the majority of the cases, I would say it was inappropriate. There was one circumstance pretty early on where President Vesey had been scheduled to serve as the member of the first presidency at a celebration of a congregational birthday, like the 130th or 135th anniversary of a congregation. And he was not able to keep that commitment. And President Shaw wasn't able. He already had a prior commitment. And so I was the member of the first presidency that was available to fill in for President Vesey. And we were approaching the date of that event, and I hadn't heard what kind of responsibility they wanted me to have or what kind of ministry they wanted me to bring. And so I finally called the Mission Center president to see if there was something going on. And the person just kind of hem-hawed around. And finally I said, well, is there an issue because I'm a woman? And there was this long kind of relief, and yes was the answer. This was one of the congregations where there had been a significant split with the matriarchal person, and several of the early founders of the congregation had split off with a restoration group. And they had, finding out that I was going to be the member of the presidency that was going to come, they had decided they would not come to the anniversary, so that this event was going to be canceled if I was the member of the presidency that was going to be represented at the event. And so I just said, kind of off the cuff, well, then we'll make other arrangements to have someone come to the celebration. Now, overnight, I got to thinking about that, and I'm not someone who reacts immediately to circumstances. I think of them through. But my morning, I was having this a little bit of an angry response going, wait a minute, that is not who we are as Community of Christ. We don't negate people because of gender. And so I mentioned to my colleagues what had happened. They got really angry, and I had to say, okay, wait a minute, guys, hang on. It was not a matter of whether this kind of circumstance would happen. It was a matter of when it would happen. It's just that this has happened fairly early in my tenure in the first presidency. I think this is what I'd like to have happen. The apostle over this particular jurisdiction had already stepped in as the representative of the presidency for the actual event. And they made the decision at the congregation they would go ahead and have the celebration. And I said, but I'm not going as a member of the first presidency. I want to go as a visitor, because in Community of Christ, we don't make gender distinctions like this. So my husband, being quite concerned that I might face some kind of mistreatment, insisted that he must go along, plus the member of the Council of 12 is going to be there as well. And so we went to the congregation, and were there for the early event where the women were up front and they could tell the stories about the history and founding of the church and the congregation. And happened, unfortunately, to see ourselves in the pew of the matriarch of the congregation, who made it quite clear she didn't want us to be sitting in her seat. Like, who are you and why are you sitting in my seat? So we moved out, and my husband said, well, we're here to, because I'm the pastor of Stone Church and we're getting ready to celebrate our 120th anniversary. We thought we'd come and see how it's done. And this was a great place to come since you're having this good celebration. And so we had a little conversation with her, and it was pretty apparent she wasn't sure who I was or didn't know who I was, which was okay. But when the apostle came, he was in between the two services, he was quite upset that they had not recognized my presence. So he wanted to make sure that the pastor acknowledged that I was there as a member of the First Presidency. And then at the end of his sermon, he was going to invite me up to bring my statement or my acknowledgement of the congregation as a member of the First Presidency, which I did. And the matriarch did not get up and leave when I was up front, but she certainly did keep her distance from me during the potluck afterwards. To the good, the pastor then invited me to come back to the congregation to bring ministry, preaching ministry at a later date. And when I did, it was a very welcoming congregation. He had passed on his apologies. The Mission Center president passed on his apologies, and all was well. But it was just one of those kind of early experiences that, as women who have been in positions of leadership, we know that there are those that we will encounter and do encounter who are either intimidated or, I don't know, frustrated or what, by having women who may have more authority or over men or that particular person. And it does build some awkwardness. I think as women in our own positions, and part of what I've found in my ministry as a congregational consultant and even in the presidency, is our ministry is as valued as men. We bring a different type of ministry because of our personality, because of the type of gifts that we have been given by God. We show our giftedness in different ways, and women are not the same in how they bring ministry. And so even in my role in the presidency, I mean, if it had been a different woman as the first, a different person as the first woman in the presidency, it would have been a different type of presidency. So, yeah, I served, in a position, certainly I served as Becky Savage with my giftedness, but I served as a woman with this particular giftedness working together with the men who were also in the presidency. If it had been a different woman with different giftedness, it would have had a different kind of structure and ministry as first presidency. So, yes, I represented women as a member of the first woman in the presidency. I also served as a person, as a woman or man. I served as a person with colleagues who served in their giftedness. So, there was responsibility, though. My thesis was on the journey of women toward ordination and community of Christ. And I did a literature review about all of the various leadership roles that women had as they were, as the church grew. And it was just fascinating to review all of the things that had happened by the various leaders of women in church, even though they were not in, obviously not in priesthood, but they were still in leadership roles and exhibited and used great tenacity in their roles and overcame various circumstances and social barriers and church hierarchy to still sustain their need to be in ministry in no matter what community they were involved in, a congregation or circumstance. There was just this continuing tenacity, that's what I would call it, of women to say we're here to serve and we have this particular calling to serve. So there is all of that heritage that comes way before me And there's all of these women that are currently bringing ministry now. You're there bringing ministry, and all of these women coming into the future that are bringing ministry that will just enrich us even more. So just this, in this little spot of time, this little 7 years of time, seven, is that what it's been? Nine, whatever it's been. I've lost track of my time. Anyway, in this role, for this little bit of time, thankfully, it's been a gift. It's really been a gift.
Yeah, thank you. I think that it's been, well, I know me coming into the church, we came in as, you know, you had already had been serving in the role that you were in. And it was a good image to walk into a church and say, you know, this isn't some tokenism. We're just going to say we ordain women, but not really utilize them or do anything with them. There was women on every level of leadership that we saw, including the first presidency. And I know for me coming in as a newbie, it was a really good image of, I guess, like a first glance image of what that meant. And then to know that, to hear your story further and to know that they actually were utilizing you, to the best of your abilities to, help guide and organize and, refine the church in a way that was, using your giftedness to the best of their capabilities and also to stretch you a little bit too. I'm really grateful that our church is serious about that. And we're serious about using the people that we have, to further this along. So I'm grateful. But you recently just, have been transitioning to yet again, another new role. We were at the World Conference when you were released from the first presidency, and then you were called to the office of evangelist. And I think that that's another thing that I really appreciate about our church is that once you retire from maybe a really broad or significant, whatever word you want to call it, leadership position, that you can step into something that it looks completely different and that's maybe not something you've ever done before. And maybe it's a little bit quieter or a little more personal or behind the scenes or whatever it may be. But we had Andrew Bolton go from Council of 12 to 70, and then we had you go from first presidency to evangelist. So talk about that a little bit. Did you, I guess, see the call to evangelists coming, or how has that transition been for you? How have you, I mean, I guess you're pretty new at being an evangelist. So what are your thoughts on that?
Well, this is one of those calls that I had a premonition about or knew about. Actually, back in the 80s, how's that for going way back? Is that right? 80s? No, 90. In Florida, what was then presiding evangelist Raphael was holding a series of classes down in the Florida Mission Center. And I had decided to go into the class on evangelism. And I'm sitting in that class and just had this overwhelming wash of assurance that at some point in my future, I would be called to be an evangelist. There was this, I don't think we called them specifically ministers of blessing at that time, but all of the encounters that I had had with those who were in the office of evangelist, it was just a perfect match, as those individuals certainly brought blessing in the various ways that they ministered. It was still a position. The priesthood responsibility is a worldwide responsibility, meaning it's not assigned just specifically to a congregation. Those in the office of evangelists are also high priests, which means that they have responsibilities beyond the congregation. Certainly can be congregation-based, but they serve, say, in the mission center as a whole, or may have responsibilities throughout other assignments in the World Church. So when President Zizi was talking with me in terms of the timing of the call to move out of the presidency, he was also presenting the call to evangelists. And I was just sharing with him that at some point I felt that that would be a call and that I was ready for that type of a call. If there were various times in our family life when evangelists had been very important, and one of the most significant had been as my mother was approaching end of life with her Lou Gehrig's. She had a form of Lou Gehrig's or ALS that was progressed over about 8 years. So many people who have Lou Gehrig's, it's a very quick, less than 2 years kind of a progression because it starts in their throat area and very quickly they can't eat and obviously die quicker. Mom started in her feet and moved up her body, and she, over really a fairly lengthy period of time, progressively lost use of muscle control. And so, because of it taking a while, she also had time to prepare herself and us, mostly us, I think, for her ultimate death. But Everett Graffio, again, as presiding evangelist, was her pastor and her minister of blessing. He helped prepare for her blessing, her celebration of life service. And he gave an end of life blessing for my mom and my dad. That for them, who dad had been her primary caregiver, this was my dad when we were growing up, who was never home, never home. And mom was the caregiver all of the time. And to see this complete switch in roles where my dad did cooking and the washing and the bathing and the entertaining and being there for whatever mom did. He devised adaptive devices to allow her to be as independent as possible, a ramp into the shower so she didn't have to worry about going to a bed bath too soon. She could stay into a place where she could be as independent and give her own shower as long as possible, or devising a device where she could feed herself and adapting that device so she could continue to feed herself as she had fewer and fewer uses of fingers. I mean, amazing things that she could ring a bell with shoulder and then just with her head. And it was amazing the kinds of things he did. And he was becoming exhausted in that caring, so that whenever it came as their minister of blessing, he not only included mom as the person who was dying, but included dad as the person who was experiencing the death and the loss and the grief and the exhaustion as caregiver. And it was such an important part of ministry for them in helping in the transition to this normal part of life, which is end of life and transition to the beyond. So, and certainly have had relationships, particularly with significant women, evangelists in my life who have been there, at significant times when I needed them, that I know that this particular office, and ministry can be, when I'm ready and get better at it, a very, very wonderful time in my life. So I'm really new, as you can imagine, just being ordained in June, and am just beginning to understand after the class, obviously, a little of what the call will mean and how I might be able to be involved in it into the future.
Well, I'm really excited for you and for the church. I'm working right now with Chris Judd towards an evangelist blessing, and I'm kind of new, you know, on the other end of this, but seeing her and her giftedness and knowing you just a little bit that I've gotten to know over the last week or so, I can definitely see why that's a good fit for you. And I have no doubt that as you grow into that and that you'll thrive. And I can only imagine the pressure that's on evangelists. I think that maybe us common folk, we might have our expectations maybe a bit, maybe too high a little bit, I guess is what I'm trying to get at. And just knowing that we're all on this journey and constantly getting called to new things and even new things within the same office or outside of priesthood, even, and just having that patience and love with each other and allowing us to grow. But I do think that there's a wisdom there, and that your experiences leading up to this point, I think, will only serve you well in the call of evangelists. So I'm excited for what you're going to bring to people and to congregations and all the different ways that evangelists can touch lives.
The views expressed in this episode are of those speaking and do not necessarily reflect the official views of the Latter-day Seekers team or of Community of Christ. The music has been provided by Ben Howington. You can find his music at mormonguitar.com.